All right, I'd like to welcome everyone to the first debate. And I'm Michael Ellis, and I volunteer to kind of be the mediator, referee. Although these guys are such good friends, I doubt there will be much blood.
Just a moment.
So, James provided the introduction for me, so I'll just read it. Stephen Carter and James Goldberg are the sort of friends who like to share Indian food, make elaborate plans for Book of Mormon video games together, and don't mind a disagreement if it's dressed up nice. Stephen is the editor of Sunstone Magazine and a master of many genres, whose works include the iPlates comics series, the essay collection What of the Night, and the middle grade horror novel The Hand of Glory. And James is a co-editor of the Mormon Lit Blitz contest and a man of many genres himself. His works include the play Prodigal Son, the novel The Five Books of Jesus, and a forthcoming poetry collection entitled Let Me Drown with Moses, which sounds very interesting. Their debate today is over the role of the Mormon writer in the Mormon community. Stephen will be arguing for a model of the writer as a voice of conscience and critique, while James will take the con side and argue against that model. So the way things will go, we'll have opening arguments, 7 minutes each, and I will time them. And then after that, we'll have rebuttals, 3 minutes each. And then we'll open up to questions from the audience or questions for each other. And then we'll do that until about 40 after the hour. And then we'll have closing arguments, 5 minutes each.
Do you have like little signs you're going to hold up?
Out.
To Tony?
Yeah, I'll just do...
Okay.
Two, one.
Okay, so let me get the timer. So we're doing 7 minutes, so you're going first.
Yep, I'm going first.
Okay, ready? Go.
Thanks for coming, everyone. I want to start with a quote. See if you can figure out who said it. Woe unto you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites! For you are like unto whited sepulchres, which indeed appear beautiful outward, but are within full of dead men's bones and of all uncleanness. Even so, ye also outwardly appear righteous unto men, but within you are full of hypocrisy and iniquity. They ring any bells? You're right. That was Jesus. And he was critiquing the religious leaders of his day, and he obviously wasn't pulling any punches. He didn't have much of a PR department back then. And of course, we're supposed to be like Jesus. So he was most definitely the conscience and a critiquer of the Judaism of his time, and quite an outspoken one. And if you look back through the scriptures, you can see that quite often the whole reason that a prophet appears among the people is to be a voice of conscience, is to sort of put them back on the right track, is to critique what's going on. They are, as far as I could tell, never called upon to come let everybody know that all is well in Zion, and they can just keep on doing what they are doing. So the role of being a religion's conscience and critic does have plenty of authoritative precedence. However, we humans are like little walking cameras. We take a tiny, almost random view of our world just wherever we go. You can follow us like on an Etch-a-Sketch around the world to see the tiny little bits of experience that we've been able to gather from where we've seen and what we've heard and what is processed through our minds, which is, of course, completely different from anything else that anybody else in the entire world, even somebody who was walking alongside us the entire time, would have gotten a completely different view of the world. So our experiences and resulting thoughts are only complete enough to qualify us for small critiques. And these are often critiques that have been made before and made better. So how can we make at least a little bit of progress toward overcoming this limitation? I say that it's mainly by using the unique tools that we're talking about today, which is fiction writing. Now, the power of story is that it allows the readers to become at one with characters for a little while. It allows us to step outside of ourselves and into the lives of others, and it allows us a small experience of at-one-ment. So fiction, instead of directly pointing to faults or failures or injustice, creates empathy by putting the readers into a character's lives. So when we connect with the characters, we see that their lives are complicated. We see that they're often like ourselves. And we see that we are indeed brothers and sisters in significant ways. And instead of interacting with each other through theory, we interact with each other directly. We get practice doing that by reading fiction. So we become better connectors with actual people instead of seeing them through the filter of our ideology. So, theories and ideas are inevitably traps. Though they at first seem liberating, they inevitably turn out to be just a larger cage. And it's fun to explore it for a minute, but eventually we come to its end. They can never take into account the complexity of a single human soul. That can only be done experientially. In other words, if the reader is at one with the characters, their critique is going to take care of itself, because we can never again treat badly the person in whose soul we have dwelt. So Mormonism simultaneously helps and hinders us from creating empathetic narratives that don't fall into the theory trap. How long do I have left?
2:45.
Excellent. Ooh, gosh, I gotta go. On the positive end, it has a way of pulling us out of our bodies and out of the world for brief periods, such as when it encourages us to fast, pray, and go on missions. We get chances to become conscious of our bodily desires and the world's values, and we get to get outside of those. We get to look at them from outside, which gives us some degree of control over them. And this is really good, and this gives us a huge head start that a lot of people don't get. However, Mormonism also resists the questioning of itself in some ways, just as every other culture does, I should point out. So, for example, there's the idea of the psychosocial moratorium, which the psychologist Eric Erickson talked about. He said that in young adulthood, often a person needs to go and sever ties with the culture that they grew up in, go into a place where they can start to understand what parts of themselves were put together by the culture and what parts of themselves are actually themselves. And once they find themselves, then they come back to the culture, but they found their source. They're no longer motivated by the culture. They are motivated by themselves, and they become a unique person who can contribute uniquely to the culture. This is what Joseph Campbell meant with his monomyth. He said that you have to go out of the culture, you have to go into the strange world, but you have to bring back the elixir so that you can bless the community in your own unique way. So whenever I ask people about Mormonism's psychosocial moratorium, they say, oh, that's the mission. I say, well, what's the mission of psychosocial moratorium for you? Thank you. And they usually, as you can see, usually not. Usually that's because you get absolutely ingrained in Mormonism at that time. So you get to see the world from a different perspective, and that's really important. But I'm thinking that you absolutely have to go through this process with Mormonism as well, because then you come back as the spirit child of God, the unique spirit child of God that you are, in order to bless the community uniquely. So, to sum up, the Mormon writer needs to go on this journey. The Mormon writer needs to come back as their own soul, and then create the empathetic narrative so that we can come into empathy and at-one-ment with characters so that we can connect with each other, period.
Thank you.
I got a little nervous as we conceptualized this debate that I'm the voice against conscience. I'm now apparently also the voice against empathy. But that's only two strikes, and it takes three to get out. In all justice, I don't... There's a good case for conscience, and I don't want to be the one who says the point of the writer is to say all is well in Zion, right? We have scriptural warnings against that. We have scriptural injunctions to improvement, conscience, and critique. The thing that troubles me and the reason I was willing to argue on this other side and actually motivated to argue on this other side is there's some disconnect between the theory we've talked about as Steve has gone through this process of empathy and unique insight and critique and what I see on the page as I survey Mormon literary fiction. And it's not always the case, but there's sort of a recurring pattern if you start to read literary Mormon short stories where clearly something went wrong on the way to that insightful spiritual critique. And I'd like to describe it that way. You know, one example of Jesus promoting internal critique is when he tells you that if your hand offends you, to cut it off. Right? That even something that's close and possessive to you, there's times when you need to distance yourself from it. That's extremely difficult to do in practice. And so I think all of us as human beings, when we get to the moment where there's something difficult to do, the self-critique, we immediately run like heck. We try to escape that obligation. And so I think there's a tendency for a writer who sets out to have this noble voice of conscience to first distance themselves, and there's a step. We've used conscience and critique interchangeably, but I do think there's a distinction, right? Conscience implies that you're included. Critique often implies that you're not. And so what I see is a separation when the writer comes to view themselves as the critic, the bearer of a message, we're going to reform the community, they no longer fully identify themselves with the community they long to reform. And so we switch from "we have sinned" to "you have." And actually, I realized as I thought about some of the short stories that drive me crazy, it's easy to make one more step back from a story that accuses another community of things and calls them out. Maybe even as Jesus, right? "Woe unto you, Pharisees, scribes, and hypocrites." The third step back is what I call the "they" step, where the story ceases to address the people it's trying to reach and instead turns to someone else who has the same critique, and now we gossip with each other about the narrow-minded Mormons over there. Right? It is so easy to set out to bring a message and end up on a ramyumptum saying, "Holy, holy God, we thank thee that we are literary writers who understand the true critique of the late 20th century liberal agenda and are able to ascend beyond the faith tradition that we were born in." And I see this in the page again and again, right? And often we inhabit a point of view then that cheats a little bit and doesn't weigh the full implications of what it takes to create a community, but sort of hand selects for showing us the point where the critique is most marked, right? Elevating this sense of pain. In New Play Project, once we had a play that was about a missionary who'd come home early for health reasons. This was a draft play. We didn't end up performing it. But then the whole play was a dialogue between him and church members who are judgmental, right? And I said, okay, on the one hand, that might reach someone who's going to say those judgmental things and work in their lives as a source of reform. But it can also increase the sense of alienation that that poor missionary feels. And as an audience member, I'm not going to identify with the caricatured judgmental character, even if I am that person. I said, what if we rewrote this script and tried to follow the point of view of the person who is making the mistake, right? And we're able to inhabit that. Maybe then we could do on a connection. But I think that the default position, whether we actively say that we're trying to treat writers as the critics of society or unconsciously absorbing that tradition from a long Western tradition of doing so, 2 minutes. Our tendency is to fall into the "they" discourse or the "you" discourse and just have a subculture sort of polarized discussion rather than critique. So what should we do instead? Passover is coming soon. And the rabbis say, before you tell the story of the Exodus, they go through this parable of four children to tell you what sort of audiences there are in any community. And they say, one child is wise. And the wise child asks, what are all the customs associated with this and what do they mean? The second is the wicked child. The wicked child is every bit as bright as the wise child. There's only two words different in their question. They say, what does all this mean to you? To you and not to them, because they separate themselves, right? And put themselves in that position of critique. You have a third child who's simple, and a fourth child who does not even know how to ask a question. The way that I wish Mormon writers would think of themselves is as engaging specific audiences in the way that they can access best. To the wise child, I think Mormon writers have a potential to engage the Mormon imagination more fully than maybe we get in our Sunday-to-Sunday Latter-day Saint experience. So I love works that try not to critique Mormonism, but to fully engage it, to explore the possibilities. And in many cases, the gospel critiques us plenty. Right? As we fully engage with imagination, we begin to see what needs to change and what's wrong. Some Mormon works do need to just represent the values of the community. What do you say to the simple child? You say, this is because the Lord brought us out of Egypt with a strong hand. We have some narratives that we, who are so sophisticated, love to make fun of, but are useful. Done?
10 seconds.
10 seconds.
7.
And then sometimes we need to initiate a conversation with those who don't know how to ask a question rather than rehashing the questions we've debated ad nauseum.
So now I have 3 minutes to respond. Is that the thing?
Yep.
Okay.
Rebut.
All right. Well, the first thing that comes to my mind is that part of the difficulty of being able to write well is making it to the point where you can write well. So I brought up the idea of the monomyth of how you leave the community, you go through a strange place, and eventually you get the elixir and you return to the community with that elixir that hopefully improves the community. And the interesting thing is, we live in a particular time and place where people have a lot of room to be able to write while they're going on the journey. And so you spend a lot of time on the journey out of the community, after a sense, so that you're seeing it from outside. And it's an all-important journey from my point of view. I went through it, and it really helped. I came back, and I was like, wow, look at all this stuff that I have to play with. But I had to get out and be able to see how it was working, see how it worked with everything else, and so that I could understand its beauty. It's basic T.S. Eliot, right? You leave the place, and you come back around, and you see it as if for the first time. The thing is, if you're a writer, you're usually writing this entire time, and so these people, it seems to me, who are on the journey, especially in the earlier parts of the journey, tend to write things that drive James crazy. And I can totally see that, too. So, on one hand, I would think that we need to be a little bit patient so that we can help these people. You know, it's all a progression. You're always coming to new insights. I am not the same person I was 10 years ago by any stretch of the imagination. And I'm really grateful for the people who were patient with me and helped me along to the place that I'm at now. The other thing that I want to bring up is the idea. Is the idea that all things must fail. That's what St. Paul told us. All things must fail. The only thing that doesn't fail is charity, which is the empathetic connection, the at-one-ment. That doesn't respond to anything you said, though.
But it's good.
Except the stories fail, too. That's the thing. Stories will always fail. The stories that we write and the stories that propel our lives, every one of those things will fail, and we will always find ourselves in a Job-like position where everything that used to uphold us will be gone. That will happen. And in my opinion, we need to let people know that they're not going to be alone when they're there, and that it's okay when all things fail. And that will often happen in difficult stories.
The first thing I'd like to say in response, there's a scripture somewhere, Paul said it. but he says that God will turn all things to the good of those who call upon his name. And I think that includes all your wandering and all your mistakes, etc. So I definitely think it's possible to go through a wandering period where you're separated from the community, angry at the community, and have God not only forgive you for that period, but turn it to your strength. I think there's a risk if you're going to do this wandering from the community that you get stuck there, especially if you're publishing on the way. Because if you start publishing and giving these critiques, and your audience builds around that voice of critique and affirming their pain and having the they dialogue about the community in the distance, there's an incentive structure, right? It's hard to abandon that audience, right? Going back and finishing your journey requires then, in some ways, repudiating what people loved you for along the way. It's possible. People do it. It's difficult. I wouldn't recommend it. I don't think you have to leave the Mormon community to find the weird other land. If you've read the scriptures, it's there. It's weird. I think there's a risk if you go out to look for that different perspective. I mean, surely you should be looking out, but you can do it with Mormon eyes. I think if you say, oh, I'm taking a break from Mormonism, I'll go watch Netflix now. there's a risk that you get a broad cultural shallowness. And one thing Mormon writers have to contribute to the larger world now is a literature of commitment and how do you wrestle with commitment. And so I think sometimes we need to go deeper and really push down into our cultural roots to do that. The final thought I had is about this notion of empathy and charity. And I think if writers can do their best to extend that empathy and charity to everyone. I think if anyone saw Richard Dutcher's States of Grace, many wonderful things in that movie. There was a huge missed opportunity. One of the subplots, you have a missionary who's fornicated with the neighbor. And his father had said before the mission, I'd rather see you come home in a coffin than come home dishonored, right? And so he has to work through that process. An interesting narrative. It's his mom who comes and picks him up from his mission. I would have loved to see Dutcher bring out the dad to say, son, when I said that, I never meant you to take it that way. And I'm sorry, and I need to think about what does I mean? Not in a way that attacks that subset of the community, right? People said that. Those sorts of attitudes exist. But give us empathy to the people who hold them. Let us see the good in them that coexists with the other things. And let's reach the empathy all the way. And I think sometimes when writers self-identify as critics, it motivates them not to extend the empathy as fully as they could within their fictional world. We end up with a selective empathizing, which I think is morally dangerous.
Okay, so now what is we open up for questions from the audience until 40 after
22. Darling.
So, you know, the title of this debate was, what is the role of the Mormon writer in the community? And you guys blow my mind. I'm so interested in all of this, and I think you'll write them down to continue this debate. But I would like to hear you each put it in one sentence. I think the writer should, I mean, Stephen, are you saying the writer should be a gadfly? And James, are you saying the writer should be empathetic? You know, just one sentence.
And actually, the first thing I'd like to see writers do for the wise child is push the limits of the Mormon imagination, right? And help us more fully and imaginatively engage for our culture. I think that's the literary writer. The sort of Mormon market writer is the writer for the simple child. I think they need to try in narratives to express the core values of the community. And then I think there's times, we talked about the child who does not even know how to ask a question. Here's actually an idea I'm stealing from Stephen Carter. He talked about times in life where his example was marriage versus courtship. We have so many narratives of romance and courtship, and very few about what is it like over years of marriage. So he said he and his wife got to a point, they're married, they've got some kids, they've got jobs, what's the story? And he calls it narrative poverty. Right, times where it's hard to think about what's the story of your own life. I'd also like to see Mormon writers in Mormon ways engage and alleviate narrative poverty by jumping in and starting new conversations and finding new areas for us to examine what our heritage might mean, what this wisdom from God could do in areas no one has talked about. Disengage from the big debates, go create new conversations. Those are the three roles that I would most love to see Mormon writers abandon the wicked child rule for and report to.
Well, I would actually answer your question directly by saying the role of a Mormon writer is to repent, period. But by repent, what I mean is, you brought up the idea of cutting off your hand if it offends you, or plucking out your eye if it offends you. And that's a fascinating metaphor, because he's not talking about something that's alien to you. He's talking about something that is a part of you, like since birth, a natural part of you. And if it's not working, then you need to get rid of it. And we all have illusions that we need to get rid of. In fact, that's pretty much every theory that we have. Every idea that we have is eventually going to become a cage. The only way to actually connect with other people and to connect with God is to make a direct connection, which is entirely experiential. St. Paul said, we see through as through a glass darkly. Jesus said you have to be born again. And so before you're born, you're in a tiny little place. Everything's muffled. You see only the barest outlines of light. You have no clue what it's like outside the womb. That's what we are like, you and I. And I have not seen nor have ear heard the things that God hath prepared for those who love him. So we know nothing right now about what reality is. That's absolutely true. And if we are trying to actually connect with what is worth connecting with, then we have to let go of everything. Jesus said you have to hate mother and father and your children. You have to let go of your riches, everything, in order to actually make that. And so the Mormon writer is kind of a public flagellant who instead of flagellating other people should actually be flagellating themselves to flaunt everything away from them that is keeping them from God, which is pretty much everything. So a public repenter, someone who is critiquing society by releasing themselves from all of those things that hold us back.
The scriptural metaphor, just to quickly respond to that notion in a debate form, I just want to get it. But those of you who read the five books of Jesus know I'm kind of obsessed by the notion of the kingdom of God. And what did Jesus mean with building up the kingdom of God? And I'm interested in the earthly part of that. But I think in some ways, the Western, especially romantic tradition of the writer is very individualistic. I'd like to see us adopt a more communal vision of the writer that looks at what is the writer's role along with lots of other roles, and not necessarily greater than any role, hopefully not all that much worse, at building up these relationships between people and this way of interrelating that in my mind constitutes the kingdom of God. And so some of that, I think, will be stripping things down. Some of it is also learning to build things up. And in some ways, that is a lot more difficult and a lot more alien to the Western literary tradition. You want to tell people?
Oh, yeah. Is Holden? Okay.
This debate reminds me a lot of the Harlem Renaissance. I know James is very familiar with this. Because W. E. Dubois used to argue kind of what James is arguing, that communal kind of thing. We're serving the black community by being artists. And then people like Langston Hughes would take the much more individualistic kind of thing. What we've got in our community is this idea of redemption. How do we redeem? How do we get redeemed? All things fail. And so we need redemption. And so, is redemption that communal aspect? We without our dead aren't saved. We without our families aren't saved. Or is it an individual relationship with Jesus? I just wanted to kind of throw that out there and what are your thoughts about Harlem Renaissance, communal versus personal salvation, and things like that.
I can't speak much about the Harlem Renaissance. But I suppose from both a scientific and a theological standpoint, especially if it's Eastern flavored. Once you start to understand how your body works and how your body came together, you do realize that, that everything that, that is in your body has been pretty much everywhere else in the universe as well, and that parts of there in me were once in you. You give blood, perhaps. There is blood from your veins flowing through someone else, which was drawn from the ground, from the detritus of other people who have died. And so physically, we are a community, and to talk about us being individual is, in a way, very silly. And I think that that's very true in a spiritual sense as well. Mormonism has definitely a bent toward thinking about us as individuals. We talk about ourselves as if we were individuals in the premortal life, as if we had at least semi-individuality as even intelligences, you know, uncreated parts of the universe that were developed into spirits. So we tend to think about ourselves as being individuals who will retain our individuality from sphere to sphere to sphere. And so that actually pushes against the communal idea. But you're right. Joseph Smith said, we can't be saved unless we're saved with our dead. And so that's why I've emphasized that empathy is absolutely the best critique. Because once we connect, we can't treat each other badly anymore.
I still do sometimes, but I feel bad about it.
You're almost there.
Yes. Just a little. No, I mean, I think both, there's both. And one thing, too, to say about this debate or something is there is a productive tension between if you go all one way. We should critique each other in terms of how do writers actually think about themselves, probably in multiple ways. And it's productive to have, whether it's Hughes and Dubois, whether it's Carter and Goldberg, a couple ways of thinking about yourself tossing around your head. But as a writer, keep them competing. Don't just fall into unconsciously thinking about yourself in one unproductive way.
Forgive me because I came in a little bit late and so I didn't hear everything Steve said. I have the impression that the expression here in the topic, role in the community, got translated as duty to the community or obligation to the community. And granting that any member of community does have duties and obligations, role in may not be quite like that. And so I'm sitting here sort of mulling this over and thinking, well, my answer to that question would be the role of the writer is to write as well as he or she possibly can. Hope that somebody will publish it and that a few people will read it and leave the consequence, which is out of his or her hands anyway.
Right.
Whatever it is. Now, that's sort of simplistic, and what do I mean by write as well as he or she? But I wouldn't want to think of that exactly as an obligation or a duty. I mean, that's the way a grocer in the community works. And they have obligations and duties, not to cheat, to provide good food, a cobbler, a plumber, there aren't any now.
So I knew quickly, I want to respond to this quickly. D. Michael Martindale on Steve's Facebook will express this another way, which is, the role of the Mormon writer is to do whatever they want, and I don't want to hear two schmucks debate it and tell them what to do. And I said, as schmuck number two, I hope you would at least be entertained by the process. But no, I think this notion of whether it's expressed as the writer should do what they want or the writer should write as well as they can, whatever your sense of doing what you want or writing as well as you can is probably shaped by the history of writers before you. And whether you ever study something like Romanticism or the, you know, social activist Upton Sinclair sort of model of American writers who are influential, whether you ever study them or not, they influence you. And what I think both of us would agree on here is you should think about what those influences are and how you think your role, right? You're going to play a role in the community no matter what. Take a more active accountability for it, right? And ask yourself, what does it mean to write as well as I can? Not just in terms of craft, although definitely learn craft, but how can craft serve an end of connecting to someone and changing their life in a positive way? Should we try to sneak in Lance's question before?
Yeah.
I was just going to piggyback on something that Bruce said. And I don't remember the quote exactly, but somewhere Virginia Woolf says that the duty or the obligation or the onus of a writer is to step away from the community to a certain point so that they can write. And behind that is a room of one's own. Do you know which quote I'm talking about, Bruce?
I actually don't. It sounds to me a little bit like something that Virginia Sorensen, who was certainly impacted by Woolf, said in an essay of hers, where she talked about the writer as a kind of outsider, almost by necessity, especially a novelist, having to sort of stand apart from certain kinds of overt commitment.
But that community can sometimes be so demanding, it can become claustrophobic. And so I think that there needs to be a time when you're apart and a time when you're together. And so it's not either or, it's both and. And one has to find a kind of livable synthesis or paradoxical relationship between those.
If I could piggyback a tiny bit on that, I was going to ask as a further sort of specification or particularization of what I said, does Marilynne Robinson worry about what her fellow Congregationalists in Iowa think about her books?
Shall we wrap these things into our closing arguments?
Are we that close?
Yeah.
She's a serious Calvinist, practicing Congregationalist, part of community.
Now, we didn't decide, do you want to go first on this, or should I go first? If you feel the need for the last word, I will defer. If you want to just jump in, I'll let you go. But pick quick.
First.
At the beginning, so should at the end.
Yeah,
I'm going to jump on. So Lance kind of made an argument for Stephen. In the guys who commented, of course. You did. Well done. But I just want to refer to that and say again, this is the inherited writerly wisdom about what the role of writer is. And it's not universal, but the predominant Western tradition, again, I think we've had two or three points of reference, is the writer should sort of step out of the community, comment on the community, critique the community, etc., right? Create a separate inner life from the constraints of community. And I just don't think that's what Mormon writers should do. And maybe part of it is that other people have done it well already and created that interiority. I think part of what is sociologically distinct about Mormonism today is how close we are together. I don't know if you guys have heard the story of the hedgehog dilemma. It's an old European story about a bunch of hedgehogs on a mountainside. The sun goes down and it starts to get cold. And they need to huddle together for warmth. But they're hedgehogs, right? And so the closer you huddle, the more you poke each other with your quills, and so then they pull apart, but then they get cold, you know. So the hedgehog dilemma is, which is worse, freezing in the cold or getting poked by a bunch of other hedgehogs? And I feel like this is a human dilemma everybody faces, and the Mormon answer ought to be that you find a way to live with the spikes more peacefully, right? And that, I don't know, pain is sometimes Christ-like and sometimes Christ takes it away. One or the other, it's meaning-making, and you're able to live together. I don't know what Marilynne Robinson thinks, but a Calvinist Congregationalist intellectual legacy is a little bit more internal. Her work seems to be about just how do you perceive things. I want Mormon writers to roll up their sleeves and get to work in the community. Isaac Bishop Singer was someone who was always extremely involved in his community and constantly had people coming over and the phone ringing and whatever, and wrote Nobel Prize winning work anyway, which is shaped in some ways by his own experience, by his father's experience as a rabbi, always having people coming in. I grew up in the as an adolescent, but I define myself largely in terms of the Columbus, Ohio years I spent. And it's a big city of a million people, and I grew up in the village of the Riverside Ward. I mean, and it was a village, and we were close, and I know the pricks of those people, but I also know the warmth. And I wish we could find a way to communicate that and deepen that and actively step in and say, not just, here's something I've created, I hope it's good in the sight of God and the big five publishers. I would love for us to say, what can this do for my grandmother, for my home teacher, for these people? You know, how do we give some life, something usable to them? They deserve it, right? I know these people, they've served, they sacrificed, they deserved it, and I do feel a duty to them.
Here for James. Okay, so It's a really important question, and I almost think that it is off the track. This is why I think it may be off the track. What I talked about at the beginning is that you have to find your own source in order to become a truly luminous part of your community, to be able to not be famous at all, but to be able to contribute from your depth, from your own particular unique soul. And I do believe that there are own particular unique souls, and that if you find that, then you will be able to almost not even have to deal with the question of should I be in or should I be out, because you will be talking with your own unique voice, which you took years to find, which you had to cut off many hands in order to as many as you need to. But you come out, and if you are not your own unique child of God that you are, then you're going to be trapped inside of some cultural stories. You're going to be worrying about if you're too far inside or too far outside. You won't be drawing from your core. And that's the only thing that makes your writing worth anything, is if you write from your core. Otherwise, you're saying the same thing that everybody else has said, and you're nothing special. So I think that you need to find the core, and that that's the most difficult thing in the entire world, and that writers do it publicly, and that makes it really difficult for them, especially as you pointed out, because then you get an audience and you think that that's your core, but it's not. This is why Bob Dylan can be like a hero to some people, because he totally reinvented himself many times, right? And ticked people off every time. And the other thing is, the empathy to me is all important. You're right. We tend to want to critique them over there. And if you're writing fiction and you're not in empathy with the characters, and if you're not bringing your readers into empathy with the characters, then in my own humble personal opinion, you're not doing it right. Because you're saying, nope, your little idea about the world is right. You don't have to encounter that. You can stay where you are. You're right. The world is as you think it is. But that is not true. We know from the scriptures that the world is emphatically not what we think it is right now. Every one of us is deluded. The only way that we can come anywhere near understanding, really, 2 whole minutes? I was wrapping up. The only way that we can come anywhere near perceiving any kind of reality is to find our own core, which is the closest thing to us. We'll never be able to know anybody else. And then connect with that core shining through as much as possible. And it's, you know, of course, it's always difficult. We're always repenting. We're always trying to find our way back to that core. We find it for a little while, and then it goes away. People bug us, and we try it, and it's, you know, the biggest thing in the world to try to figure out how to interact with these people who are all also children of God. So that's my basic idea. You must find your core, and then you must build empathy through your writing. That is the only way to even dimly perceive what is out there. Period.
Thanks for coming, guys.
That was kind of fun.
That was fun.